Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Peter.
Episode 152, recorded on February 9th. Is GCP rebranding no-code as visual interface? I don't know. Good evening, Jonathan and Ryan. How's it going?
You go first.
Yeah.
And if you lie, I'll go along with it and say we're having a great day.
Yes. There you go. Perfect.
Fantastic.
Wonderful, Justin. How are you?
Full of honesty. Lies and deceit. That's all I see. All right. Well, it is once again our favorite time of the quarter. That's right. It's earnings time. And we're here once again with Microsoft up first with revenue of $51.7 billion for fiscal Q2 FY22. An increase of 20%. Operating income was $22.2 billion, an overall increase of 24%. A net income of $18.8 billion, which was a 24% increase. Revenue for the only part we care about, which is Intelligent Cloud, was $18.3 billion, which was a 26% increase over the prior year. And this is driven by a 29% increase in cloud revenue and other cloud services revenue growth of 46%. So that's pretty good. Nice job, Azure. Number two in the market.
So. I think at least half of that is my son's Minecraft Marketplace download. So,
did those come off of Azure? Are we paying for those for Azure? And then Alphabet was up next, coming into second here with their revenue for Q4 was $75 billion, a 32% year-over-year increase, ending the year for them at $257.6 billion in revenue for the year, a 41% increase over 2020. Hey, what pandemic? Google Cloud increased to $5.541 billion, a 45% increase year-over-year. However, the Google Cloud division still lost $890 million in Q4. And lost $3.1 billion for the entire year. The full year run rate of Google Cloud was $22 billion, which is pretty nice based on the Q4 revenues. And they also announced that they were going to do a stock split for Google, a 20 for one. So on Tuesday, the stock was about $2,700. You could basically get stock for $135-ish after the stock split when that goes through. So there you go. If you are ever one to own Google stock, this might be your chance because it'll actually be cheap enough to do so. Yeah. If you're not into buying portions of shares.
Yeah. It's kind of disappointing that the Q4 earnings is a larger loss than this time last year, right? Because that was their big recover was Q4 of 2020, right?
Yeah. But I mean, still, if you look at the trend, they're still trending down. Yeah. They will probably make money sometime, maybe this year even, if they continue to grow revenue at the rate they're growing revenue. So. And if they, they can build 12 more data centers, I'm sure it changes the equation quite a bit.
Well, that's what I wonder. I wonder how much they've invested in, right? Because that's the big numbers and the big things that can change one way or the other.
Yeah. Now, again, if you're a cloud provider, you would love to have a lot of revenue. And, you know, Microsoft with their $51.7 billion, Google with their $75 billion, those are the parent companies. Amazon, man, made them look cheap. Their Q4 was $137.4 billion in total sales, up 9% year-over-year. However, their income did decrease to 35 million from 6.9 billion. So for the full year, the net sales increased 22% to $499.8 billion for the full year, compared to $386.1 billion the year prior. AWS Q4 results were $17.78 billion for Q4, up 40%, which means their growth number has gone up again. Now a $71.12 billion run rate business. And for the year, AWS made $62.2 billion, up from 45.37% the year before. So that summarize that down for you. That's AWS with 40% growth, Azure with 46% growth, and Google Cloud with 45% growth. So everyone's growing. Everyone's getting more money, which is great for us.
I'm no math genius, but that's way more than 100%.
All right. Well, I'm not sure what you're talking about exactly, but I'm going to go with it. It's a math joke. I don't understand. But anyways, all the cloud providers did quite well. Google's still losing money, but hopefully it will get better Amazon, actually, there was an interesting chart that I shared that isn't in our show notes, but basically it was a chart of what Amazon's outlook would look like if it didn't have AWS, and they would be very much in the red as an overall business without Amazon. So, or if without AWS. So, you know, Amazon can't let go of AWS anytime soon because they'll hurt them pretty badly.
Can't understand why they're performing so badly, though, given that everyone's buying everything.
Look at the entertainment sector.
Well,
they're just dumping money into that platform, and it's a very
well. And you know, I think they're paying a lot of money for supply chain issues. They're paying more for products. They're still building a ton of warehouses. They're hiring more people. Like they just have a lot of costs. I mean, and they've been saying for years they're just reinvesting that money into their infrastructure. You assume that if they really wanted to make that profitable, they would just pull back on some of that investment, and then they could level that out. But they feel doubling down right now is the thing to do, and so that's what they're doing.
Well, the stock price would back that up too. Value keeps going up.
Well, I mean, speaking of stock price, one of the big complaints we've been seeing on AWS has been that their equity-based compensation does not look so great when they're not growing their stock price, 20, 30, 40% a year anymore. And so they actually just announced this week that they're increasing their base salary cap from 160 to 350K, which doesn't mean that everyone's getting a raise. It just means that they'll now hire you at a higher base salary potentially than you would have gotten prior, because if you were over that 160 cap, there's nothing you can do. So it'd be interesting to see how that translates into offers for people. But with the steady stream of people leaving AWS in the last month or two, anything they can do to stop that bleeding, I think, will be helpful for them. And so hopefully they give some people some good raises and keep the staff they really need to keep on board to keep that cloud number one in the market. Yeah. And plus it helps all of us because, hey, I can go to Amazon and make $350. That's a great argument to have with your boss, right? So, all right. Well, VentureBeat has an interesting article about determining the impact of transformation programs in your organization. And they have done some investigation to determine what the four best practices will be to maximize the value of your cloud migration ROI. They contend this transformation is critical, as Forrester states that improving customer experience will increase revenue by $1 billion when you do that improvement per percentage point. Overall, they definitely point to selecting a clear leader for digital transformation and cloud migration, as they contend that transformation typically falls upon several roles in an organization. As a result, many companies lack clear ownership for their transformation, and identifying one executive who's responsible for driving the transformation and coordinating with the teams is crucial to align accountability, aka get fired when all goes wrong.
So, yeah. And that's called a scapegoat?
So I agree on this for cloud migration. Having done many cloud migrations, having a single executive who's in charge of this is super important. Having this aligned in your organization, giving them the ability to execute outside of your normal controls, to learn how to be more cloud friendly and more cloud native, I think is super valuable to your business.
I'd like to see a la the Phoenix project, that it doesn't have to be a single executive in the company. It'd be, but if you can't get all, having at least one identified one is probably the best.
I know, maybe it'd be better to hold multiple executives accountable for it so that they all have to work together to get the job done, or they all get fired. Because it's so easy now. If you hire somebody whose role it is to get this done and they don't get it done, they get canned instead of the people who didn't work with them to achieve the goal. So, nice idea if they have the agency to hold other people accountable too.
Yeah. I think there's the rub. It's in the details as usual. If you do need to operate as a business and achieve that transformation together, no matter what, any kind of migration is going to take, it's going to have an impact to, product delivery and feature roadmap, which will have an impact to the ability to sell. And so it really does take everyone marching to the same tune in order to get that done, or it just causes infighting.
I think people need to hire an expert to come along and tell them that it's actually going to take them three times as long as they first estimated, and maybe they should reconsider their initial plans.
Interesting.
Let's be realistic here.
All right, next one. Yeah, please be more realistic. Number two, ensure your organization has sufficient resources for cloud migration at scale. While there are tons of benefits of moving to the cloud, you can be held back due to security, costs, system integrations, tech debt, and leadership inertia. Apparently, only 7% of IT leaders said they have the right resources to meet the transformational goals and deadlines, and appropriate resources and budgets are needed for a successful cloud migration. 7% is shockingly low to me. I get it. I also hope that you're not starting cloud migration of scale with no people who know what you're doing. But sadly, that doesn't seem to be the case because clearly IT leaders are saying otherwise.
I mean, that's the horror stories you read about and you hear about, right? Is, you know, transformation's hard when you're starting off and you don't have anyone with that skill set, and you have to sort of either hire a massive amount of people or you have to, you know, slowly build up that expertise within your own team. And so I can imagine that most leaders on both sides of that coin are feeling like they don't have the right resources to achieve the goal.
Well, of course they don't, because previously they didn't have that goal to achieve. I mean, why would you have a whole team of cloud experts on board if you didn't use the cloud? I mean, you have to ramp up the skills, mm-hmm. you have to ramp up the headcount. I'm curious to see what the other 93% of the IT executives actually had to say, because there may be a bit of survey bias in the way the question was worded.
Could be. Yeah, it's always hard to say on these type of surveys. But, you know, I think there's so many times I've heard the story of, well, you know, we started our cloud migration journey, or we started our cloud journey. You know, we hired a few couple people in and we started working on, we started working on CI/CD because the first thing we realized was our CI/CD platform was broken. And we needed to actually fix that before we could actually go to cloud. And they spent, you know, 18 months to 2 years working on their CI/CD platform or fixing some other tech debt thing they needed to get rid of before they could really move to cloud. And in that time, you know, the board or the executive team loses faith of the CIO or CTO driving it and fires that person, only to hire the next CTO or CIO who comes in, has all that tech baggage gone, and then now just delivers crazily on their cloud story. So, you know, I would say also in this, you need to think about how you deliver immediate value versus long-term value, and how do you balance those two metrics? Because just focusing on fixing all the tech debt first will not get you the business outcome you really want. Which goes into number three, prioritize investing in cloud for business operations that have the highest revenue impact. And this is from a recent Data Dimension report, said that respondents say cloud has improved their organization flexibility by 77% and contributes to future-proofing their technology infrastructure. However, moving to cloud is a major undertaking for companies of all sizes. Plus, often there are disconnects between cloud strategy and financial return for many enterprise companies looking to capitalize on the technology. Without a well-defined cloud strategy, enterprises can fall into traps that prevent them from reaching intended goals. And companies should prioritize investing in cloud migration for the business operations that have the most direct impact on company revenue.
I kind of want to call a little bit of bullshit on that metric. How do you measure the organization's flexibility? And how do you get that number of 77%? Is it the number of times you changed what people were doing and they were able to still succeed? Like, that's what a weird metric.
You grab the organization by either end and you flex it and you see if it moves.
Shake it and see who falls out.
Yeah. I mean, this is one that I've never seen businesses get right. The safest move is always to take a small POC and push that and sort of do your cloud landing zone with that and use that as your example. And it slowly builds over time. But then you're left at a certain point where the thing that makes you the most amount of money doesn't fit necessarily your plans, and you got to do something. And it's a huge risk. And it's a lot of businesses get stuck right here trying to modernize. And, you know, how do you justify the interruption to the revenue streams and the lack of feature delivery while you're doing that transformation to the thing that pays all the bills? It's very difficult. I'd like to see more people lead with their flagship software.
That's always the big hairy beast, mm-hmm. typically, because no one's flagship software is built on monolithic microservices yeah. and Kubernetes. They're all built on monolithic Java and .NET stacks that they have to then decompartmentalize into microservices mm-hmm. over time. So, all right, number four, align the expectations of your team. Despite reports that IT and business executives value digital transformation equally, the standards used by IT leaders, managers, and executives to evaluate success can vary widely. In fact, estimates of success drop as executive seniority level decreases. Out of 98% of respondents reported successful digital transformations, 90% of the business owners viewed digital transformation initiatives as successful, while only 35% of the managers reported the same. Overall, digital transformation is a journey, not a destination.
Yeah, I think that those metrics speak wonders. You know, their accuracy could be anywhere, but it's, you know, the people making the decisions are like, yay, we won. And the people having to actually carry out and implement are like, oh my God, please no.
All right, let's move on to AWS, which is a very light week because, of course, this is AWS Performance Evaluation Week. So everyone's getting their feedback and their bonuses and hopefully all those good metric things. I don't know how that works actually. AWS, maybe that's separate. But they're getting their feedback on how they either sucked or were amazing last year, which maybe will stem some additional resignations the next few weeks. We'll see.
Or promotions for the optimists.
Or promotions. Sure, sure.
It's been like this all day.
I know. I really
am. It's been such an optimist. I'm sick of this.
It's out of character for me too.
And someone said, "You're such an optimist," earlier, and I was like, what does that mean? Like, I'm not saying I'm an optimist. I have high hopes for your execution ability, which maybe are misplaced.
I told Ryan he was 9 minutes late to do something earlier, and instead he said, "Or am I 23 hours and 51 minutes early?" I'm like, yeah whatever.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is how I entertain myself all day.
So I already know how this next story is going to go. Ryan's going to be all about this and how amazing these are. And Jonathan's going to be like, this is garbage. So, I mean, even though I don't have a lot of cloud news from your AWS, I do have new digital badges. The new verifiable digital badges are available to everyone who scores at least 80% in the assessment associated with learning plans. The badges prove your knowledge of a skill like object storage or block storage in the AWS cloud. Badges are distributed and managed through Credly and carry with them the metadata that enables verification of the issuer and their credentials and lists the skills and knowledge demonstrated by the holder. You can now start collecting your new digital badges for block and object storage today. And they're very fancy Blue Shield badges. I don't know if you guys looked at the article, but they're pretty.
I certainly don't want to rain on anyone's parade for attempting to learn anything, trying new things. It's wonderful. I love learning myself. Aspiring to earn badges that mean you didn't get a qualification and you only got 80%. I'm not sure that's the greatest motivator.
It was a minimum of 80%. It didn't say you only got 80%, but I'm equal to the person. I got 80% and I'm also equal to you who got 100% on my digital badge. So, we're equal in the eyes of the badge. We're just not really equal on how we scored.
So it's kind of like a second class certification in a way.
I mean, certification is a stretch. it's a online course I took that had a test that I passed the test. And
it's something flashy to put on LinkedIn, I guess.
A way to demonstrate a skill level that's not just your attestation on your resume, right?
And I like that, actually, because the number of people I've interviewed who said, I've been learning this, or I've been learning this, and you actually ask them questions. Well, when I say learning, I mean I downloaded some sample questions, or I did this. Like, okay, so you haven't been learning it then. But then I kind of fall foul to that, too, because I started learning Golang about 5 years ago and then never touched it again. So
I think I'm on my fourth time learning it, Golang.
It's a way for you to show to your boss that, you're serious about your training and you really will go do the Amazon certification training, which is much more expensive. Because, many times people come and say, I want to do a cloud guru or I want to do this training thing, and you put the money into it and then they never take the course. But they had the dream, at least this you can say, I already did my object storage and my block storage and I already have the badge to prove it. So clearly I'm more serious than, everyone else in the department.
I mean, I think if used intelligently as part of a overall narrative of, a journey of learning a new skill or being able to demonstrate a new skill. Awesome. But it's not a, hey, I have a badge. I know everything.
Yeah.
if
you can kind of gamify the thing and people work in teams to get more badges and you start rewarding people for more badges at the end of a quarter or year or something, then I'm sure it's a good motivator. Do you know if they expire like certifications do? Didn't say anything about that.
That's okay.
It didn't say they expire, but I assume that you would at some point need to take them again or take an additional one to get.
They do have a year.
Because if there's only a podcast you can listen to hear about all the amazing S3 and EBS block storage stuff that gets announced every week. It's constantly changing.
Just not this week.
Just not during performance season.
Just not this week. Well, I mean, technically we gave you badges. So it did change this week, just not in a technical way. All right. Well, AWS Cloud Services is now adhering to the CISP Data Protection Code of Conduct for added GDPR assurance. They've declared 52 services under the Cloud Infrastructure Service Providers Europe Data Protection Code of Conduct, which is CISP code, because I'm not going to say that again, which provides independent verification and an added level of assurance to AWS customers that their cloud services can be used in compliance with the General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR. Validated by the European Data Protection Board, or the EDPB, and approved by the French Data Protection Authority, CNIL, the CISP code assures organizations that their provider meets the requirements applicable to personal data processed on behalf of their customer per the GDPR. CSP code goes beyond GDPR in that it requires cloud service providers to give customers the choice to use services to store and process customer data exclusively in the European Economic Area. Data privacy prohibits cloud service providers from using customer data for data mining, profit, or direct marketing, and it's highly targeted at cloud infrastructure vendors who may not be represented fully in more general codes like SOC or ISO or others. You look up the 52 AWS services that are verified as a compliance with the CSP code in the CSP public register site. I should note to you both that GCP and Microsoft both beat AWS to this, but neither one of them have services listed in the self-certification registry. So, you know, I don't know if that's a new thing and they just haven't done that part yet. I don't really know how this works because I don't live in Europe. But, you know, GCP and Microsoft did it first, but they don't have the proof because I can't look it up on the site. So AWS is here, and now all three cloud providers are meeting CSP code of conduct.
It's also a breadth of services, right? There's a lower bar for Azure and GCP to meet this because they only have to do it for a subset of the services that Amazon offers. And so trying to get every last one of the, you know, internal services to meet these compliance, I'm sure is tricky.
It's going to be super important as well. You know, if you look at the hassles that Facebook or Meta is going through right now, talking about potentially having to pull out of Europe with Instagram and their main Facebook services because they can't or don't want to meet the GDPR requirements to not ship data to the US. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not going to shed a tear over that personally. But
no, I mean, I've definitely got some scars from the first, you know, GDPR stuff and working with a large email service.
Oops.
Going to need a lot of storage in a lot of different places.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on to AppRunner. For those of you who've been excited to use AppRunner, which is basically AWS's implementation of Knative, you know, you were somewhat stifled because it did not support VPCs. But not now. You can now support AppRunners running inside of VPC connections, allowing you to quickly deploy your web applications and APIs at any scale. You start with a source code or a container image, and AppRunner will fully manage all infrastructure, including servers, networking, and load balancing to your application. AppRunner also can configure a deployment pipeline for you out of the box, and this enables new capabilities, including connecting AppRunners to RDS databases, ElastiCache, or ECS, EKS, or EC2 instances, or via your on-premise via Direct Connect. Previously, they would need to be available on a public internet, so your RDS database on public internet is a no-no, but if you needed it, this is how you had to do it in the past. Which is not great. So glad to see this is finally here. It took a while for this one to get here.
Yeah, VPC support has become my new tagging. Like, I wish everything supported this at launch. You know, there's so much risk in putting resources on the public internet to get them to talk to each other. Like, you can sort of control things with security groups when it's public, but for services that you don't necessarily end the endpoint or own the endpoint, it can be very difficult. So just provide it from day one. Because once data is in the database, it's going to get, you know, no one's going to move, or, you know, the cost to move it is much higher.
I find it a little strange that they wouldn't launch with VPC support, because I would have expected that something like this would have been launched into a VPC maybe that we didn't have access to or something like that, rather than sort of more of the EC2 classic kind of account, which is kind of stinks off a little bit when you talk about only having public IP access. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm totally with you. It should be table stakes anymore.
You know, it's just one of the many things on a list that I wish they had out of the box. Like TLS is always available to you. Encryption at rest is always available to you. Cloud formation support on launch would be great. Like, there's a lot of things like this one that are in that bucket. You know, I think the Amazon's gotten better. We don't complain about some of them as much. Like CloudTrail is now pretty much a launch feature. I haven't seen one launch in a while that didn't have CloudTrail support, but you know, that used to be a big problem and it's still, you know, so there's definitely things like that still exist out there, but, you know, it'd be nice if there was sort of a deployment maturity scale or something where you could kind of define, like, does it have these boxes? And like, once it gets to a certain level, you know, you give a different ranking or something. I don't know. Not really, not a score, but, some way to know that quickly. And Amazon really should be the one to police that, but, maybe we'll build that. Mm-hmm. We could do that.
That's
be helpful.
That would be a cool tool to have.
All right. Well, now you can replicate your existing objects with the Amazon S3 batch replication feature. We previously mentioned the batch replication feature when it first launched for new objects only, and we're sad to see that it did not support existing, but now it does. The Amazon S3 replication supports several use cases. For example, you can use it to minimize latency by maintaining copies of your data in AWS regions geographically closer to your users to meet compliance and data sovereignty requirements and to create additional resiliency for disaster recovery planning. Prior to now, you could not replicate existing objects prior to this feature, but now you can. There are many reasons why customers will want to replicate existing objects. For example, customers might want to copy their data to a new AWS region, or maybe they're opening a new office that requires heavy graphic work, and they like to get that data closer to those users so they can be more effective. S3 Batch can be used for the following items: replicate existing objects, replicate objects that previously failed to replicate, which was a nice wrinkle that if you use the new object thing and it failed to replicate for some reason, you couldn't just retry. That was super fun. And then replicate objects that were already replicated to another destination, or replicate replicas of objects that were created from a replication rule. So overall, if you're looking for replication, we've got you this week with S3 Batch. Awesome.
Like if S3 was Amazon's sliced bread, this would be the best thing since sliced bread. It's like, really, it's one of the last features which I truly care about.
Yeah. I mean, this empowers so many sophisticated application deployment models. You know, and so much code has been written over time to sort of, put this in place in, a various method of ways with different levels of success. And so it's nice that this is just part of the service now.
Agreed.
Although it's going to be like, how long is it going to be before I replicate my replica, which replicates the replica, which causes a very large bill in my AWS account? It's only a matter of time.
Or you replicate between like five buckets to each other and then you get into a loop and then Amazon calls you cranky with you. Like, what are you doing? And please stop it.
I would hope they've prevented that from happening. I really would. Although that's a pretty decent moneymaker.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. Let me see how I can make a lot of money. Oh, create this API that you just replicate data around the world
circle.
Over and over again. Yeah.
Hey everyone, Jonathan here. I just wanted to take a minute to thank the cloud consulting gurus at Foghorn for helping make the CloudPod possible. These folks truly get it. Cloud consulting experts since 2008, they are premier tier partners with AWS, Google Cloud Platform Silver, and Microsoft Azure partners. From multi-cloud to containers to moving full production workloads to the cloud under the tightest compliance, Foghorn's team of full-stack cloud engineers have been there, done that, gotten the t-shirt, and are ready to share their experience with you. If you're in the market for some talent to supplement your team, visit www.fogops.io/thecloudpod. www.fogops.io/thecloudpod. Foghorn, the promise of cloud delivered.
All right. Well, GCP is unveiling a new visual user interface for Google Cloud speech to text API. And that's because Google's committed to making AI accessible to everyone and easier to harness for new use cases. The GA of their intuitive new visual user interface for Google Cloud Speech Text STT API is right in the Google Cloud Console, where you could find it right now, which makes the API much simpler and easier to developers to use. The STT API lets developers convert speech into text by leveraging Google's years of research into automatic speech recognition and transcription technology powered by Google Voice. The STT API covers a wide variety of use cases, from dictation and short commands to captioning and subtitles, and getting the most out of STT, however, can be a complicated process. Previously, developers built on the STT API by doing the work manually and carefully experimenting with the API. Just to get started, you had to have a lot of familiarity with GCP integration concepts and had to either build their own tools or manage various scripts and API calls to fully understand the API documentation. But now, with today's announcement, it's all simple. With the process that facilitates iteration and integration of models into developer applications by letting developers perform every API function within the Google Cloud Console. These tools make it easier for developers to integrate the STT API with their products or services.
I got two things. My first thought when I read the headline was, they're making it more accessible for perhaps people with disabilities, people who have a hard time using the service today. That's not what it is. It's not people with disabilities. It's business information people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. I see how you went from like, oh, this is really awesome, to, oh, this is not so great. Okay, I can see it. And what's your second thought?
And of course, the second thought is, I mean, really, it's just another move towards no code visual workflow development, which I don't know, maybe it has its place.
I hope that the pipelines don't become so complex that making a change in one area of it doesn't somehow you know, cause a tumble throughout the pipeline to have an effect somewhere else. And then you don't have any way to restore that because it's not really codified or versioned or easily manageable. Like it's going to be rough. I went on a very similar journey as you did reading through this, but very different. I read this as, you know, a speech text API in the sense that you could just yell at it for your API actions and was very confused. And now I get it. It's not that. Why would I want to yell at my API?
I mean, I can see why a visual interface or something like this would be more useful, because I mean, think of how hard it is to keep 5 or 6 words in your head, let alone 10 words or 20 different actions that you want to interpret and turn into some kind of speech-driven directive in an application. I can see why having them on a page in front of you visually makes a lot of sense. So while I make fun, mm-hmm. I can see why something like this is much more intuitive and easier to use, at least in the development phase. I would hope that you can export all this out and turn it into code and version it later on. Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying is you like no code.
I don't think I'm quite saying that. I'm thinking for this very specific.
Editor's note. Let's isolate that Jonathan Baker likes no code.
You know, it is a very subtle, textual change to call it the visual user interface. Versus no code interface or low code interface, as well as they didn't use the word bespoke to make all of us angry. So, you know, well done pivot to get away from the bespoke nature of no code and low code.
Yes, people like you like APIs like this. Oh, I really hate that. In fact, I noticed, I have the LinkedIn app installed on my phone, and I noticed over the past few weeks I've been getting these prompts like, people like you like this guy, people like you watch this blog, and it just infuriates me, the whole people like you thing, and I see it coming up all the time in marketing. And I noticed in the past couple of days the wording of that's changed now to something else. It's people who share your interests.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, okay, I can live with that. But yeah. People like me, just
yeah.
I hope there's not more people like me. I feel very sorry for
them. I mean, on one side, I'm like, yes, we need more people like Jonathan. On the other side, I'm like, no, we really don't need more people like Jonathan.
Yeah, so, it wouldn't be.
Can I be selective about which parts of you we get?
All or none. I'm sorry.
Toes.
All right. Well, Google Cloud Next, if you were paying attention to the many, many hours of online video, you know that they launched the preview of Dataproc Serverless for Spark. And if you didn't watch those videos, I'm telling you now, it's now generally available and is the industry's first auto-scaling serverless Spark implementation. And they're announcing the private preview of Spark through BigQuery as well, which we'll get to in a second. Per the IDC, developers spend 40% of their time writing code and 60% of their time tuning infrastructure and managing customers. And all I can say to that is, I wish that was true. Furthermore, not all Spark developers are infrastructure experts, resulting in higher costs and productivity impact. With serverless Spark, it allows developers to focus on code and logic. They do not need to manage clusters or tune infrastructure. They submit Spark jobs from their interface of choice, and the process is auto-scaled to match the needs of the job. Data engineering teams do not need to manage or monitor infrastructure for their end users, and they are freed up to work on higher value data engineering functions. Pay only for the job duration versus paying for the entire infrastructure time. And as part of this announcement, as I mentioned, they are also announcing what's next for serverless Spark, and that is BigQuery, to provide a unified interface for data analysis to write SQL or PySpark. The preview for that is now live, and you can request access, as well as they are working to extend this to Vertex AI Workbench and Dataplex. So this is going to go product-wide in the AI ML space for Google.
Right, so in the spirit of finishing all these stories on a high note, because Mr. Optimism there is going to say lots of nice things. I kind of feel like they're sort of abusing the serverless term a little bit here. Because if you're just submitting a job, is the concept of serverless even really relevant at that point? Isn't it just Spark as a service? Do I care whether it's serverless? Do I care whether there's some automation that deploys a thing that doesn't scale as long as my job completes in the time and gives me the answer back? Like what difference does that make to me as a user? Why isn't it just a SaaS product, just like every other product where I submit a batch job?
Right. Marketing is why, someone decided that calling the Spark Managed Service or Spark On Demand or Spark SaaS or all those things would make people angry. And so somehow serverless became the name that they all chose. And they're like, so now if it's a managed service, it's a serverless thing.
Yeah, it's a bad job. Anyway, so the second thing. All right, for you to line
Is this the positive part?
No, no. Ryan's gonna give us the positive part.
Oh, Ryan's covering the positive part. Okay.
All right. Okay. So, pay only for the job duration versus paying for infrastructure time. Really? Isn't that the same thing?
Well, I mean, because in a normal Spark cluster or a Hadoop cluster or whatever, you had to spin up a bunch of servers that sit there running 24/7. All the time. And that's infrastructure cost that you're spending even when you're not using it. For your Spark job, you're only paying when you're actually running the job. And so if you have one job a day that only runs for 20 minutes, you only pay for 20 minutes versus paying for that Spark cluster that's up and running.
Wouldn't I just bring it up and down as I needed it?
Well, you got to hydrate the data. There's nuance in there that does make this actually hard. And there's businesses that provide just this, that level of automation to their existing infrastructure.
If the developers were truly spending 60% of their time tuning infrastructure and managing clusters, then yes, you're right. They could turn off the servers and turn them back on. But we all know that's a lie. And I don't know where IDC, what developers IDC talk to, but I like to get their names and get them hired by my company.
40% of their time writing code, another 40% of their time fixing the code they just wrote. And then hopefully we get like 5% of their time at managing and attending to infrastructure. And the rest of the time is coffee.
See, I thought that 5% was escalating to the cloud team to fix their crap.
It's in there. They do that over coffee.
That's true. Yeah. But I mean, it's nice to see, they got to GA first. Amazon also has a similar feature available that's in preview. They announced at reInvent. So, glad to see both Google and AWS are getting this capability, which, if you're using Hadoop or using Spark or any of these type of things, these could save you a lot of money and a lot of headaches, which I think is a plus. Well, Google saw that AWS got that CISB code of conduct, and so they decided to double down on what they've got already in their pocket. So they're releasing the general availability of assured workloads for the European Union. This allows GCP customers to create and maintain workloads with data residency in their choice of EU Google Cloud region, personnel access and customer support restricted to only European persons located in the European Union, sorry, Jonathan, and cryptographic control over data access, including customer managed encryption keys. Interesting, the assured workload work at the folder level of your projects. And so if you're thinking about organizations, if you're AWS, you have different subdirectories. In Google, it's folders and projects. And so you can have a folder, put your projects in there for the EU Union, and then basically set the jurisdiction to either US, Canada experimental, which I think Canada is experimental, and European Union. And then for the EU, you can actually go between two different modes, EU regions and support, which is generally available today, which allows customers to restrict the storage of their data to EU, and eventually EU regions and support with sovereignty controls, which is only in preview today, but builds on the other capabilities, but adds additional levels of sovereignty by encryption customer data with externally stored and managed keys from cloud external key manager and signing access approval requests with the same keys. So this is all available to you if you're in the European Union and you want to get additional assurances that your data is not leaving the EU. This is for you.
This is a validation of your existing deployments, right? It's not a custom deployment that you're sort of utilizing in order to make it compliant.
Well, you already had to be in a European region to enable this, and then you basically turn it on, and then your workloads now get supported by European citizens.
I get it now. Okay, so this is like a back end. Because I was trying to figure out what this was. Are they making sure I'm keeping the data within a region by looking at my application code? But I see what this is.
I mean, yes, you're choosing a region in the EU, step one. And then number two, you're getting only European Union people to touch your data. And then they're giving you additional cryptographic controls over that data. So that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
This is additional.
I'm surprised it's taken such a long time, actually, because these types of controls have been enforced in the US for a very long time. US persons only or US citizens only and things like that. And of course, there's always exceptions for people with huge offshore teams because they use workspaces hosted in the US or they work for US companies and they don't have access to some of the data. So I think I'm surprised it's taken such a long time for the EU to kind of catch up to those types of requirements.
I actually don't think EU is catching up. We don't have a government mandate to keep those workloads isolated, right? We have policies and customer contracts and those types of things, but we don't have a central body. The EU is, making this law. And so I think in a lot of ways they're leading in that way. Whereas before that, every company was left to sort of design their own.
Yeah, that's fair, actually. Yeah, that's very true. In fact, when we dealt with European countries and customers there, we had like Safe Harbor to deal with, which disappeared a terrible death and things like that. So yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, you're right.
Yeah, so I do think part of this EU, you know, the CISB, COC, and all that's, you know, that's a direct reflection of Safe Harbor falling apart. And then I think if you're trying to sell to, you know, the government or to the military in Europe, you know, those different countries and such, I think you would run into those problems. But those are not big customers in those countries. Where the U.S., it's a massive mega, you know, company basically to get as a customer. And so, you know, the investment makes sense. Where in the European Union, you know, the military of Belgium is not a very big military. Yeah. and so there's not as much, you know, to do there. And so you just don't hear about those problems as much as I think you did in the U.S. where you had FedRAMP and you had all these other requirements. And then if you got those magical things, you could enable, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue charging the U.S. government for these things.
I do look forward to the day where we have not only GovCloud, but, you know, the EU GovCloud, because that will just make things more awesome.
I think Azure has that, actually. I think Azure has, I think they have a different, I think they have an Australia region for GovCloud, and I think they also have a European one as well.
But is it geared towards Americans' government? Like, is it?
Well, I mean, the Australian one's tied, you know, targeted towards Australian governments, mm-hmm. and the one in Europe is tied to European Union companies. Although I don't know about London, you know, because UK exited the EU. I don't know with them, but. Yeah. So actually, I said earlier that Jonathan could do this, except he was in the wrong country. But actually, he's not a European Union citizen either. So, you know, from that side, so he's screwed.
My passport still says I am, but when I get it renewed, who knows? Yeah, I guess it's interesting because the U.S. deals with other countries at the federal level because that's the way the system is built. And Australia is probably small enough that it does the same, a small enough in terms of population and sort of organization that does the same thing. But when it comes to Europe, it's very strange because some of the things which are sort of delegated, what's the opposite of delegated? Interesting.
Responsibility hoarding?
Yeah. Well, it's like, you know, some things were pushed off into the control of the central, sort of the more central management layer, and some things are still a responsibility of individual countries. And data protection has still very much been at the individual member level, which is why France has got their own rules. The UK had their own rules and Germany's got their own rules. And so it's got to be a bit of a nightmare. I think the only way to make this work is to unify that and just have one common set of controls.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right. Well, if you are using any of the Security Center products from Google, you're getting some new capabilities. As organizations move to the cloud, VM-based architectures continue to make up a significant portion of computer-centric workloads. And to help ensure strong protection for those deployments, Google is thrilled to announce the public preview of their Security Command Center Virtual Machine Threat Detection, or VMTD. VMTD is a first-to-market detection capability from a major cloud provider that provides agentless memory scanning to help detect threats like crypto mining malware inside of your virtual machines running in Google Cloud. Traditional endpoint security relies on agents inside the guest virtual machine gathering signals and telemetry. Just as is the case in many other areas of infrastructure security, cloud technology offers the ability to rethink existing models. And they rethought this by going to the hypervisor and just using the hypervisor, which is great. You know, VM2D complements the other parts of the SCC, which includes the event threat detection and the container detection, security detection products. So if you are worried about what's happening in memory of your instances, this might be a great solution for you. I assume it does more than crypto mining. It's just what they use as their example, or, you know, at least that's where they started at, but I assume that other things will get added over time.
Yeah, it's probably the most expensive mistake that people make is crypto miners spinning up teams of machines. But interesting. I mean, I think one of the other concerns that people have is that the RAM of their VMs is not encrypted, which is why a lot of the new generation of silicon encrypts RAM for VMs with their own keys. And so this would be something that would be very difficult to do with those newer instances if you also wanted to have encryption.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's always the two sides of that sword, right, for security. Like, we wanted encrypted so no one could access it, but I need access to it so I can tell what it is.
Encrypt everything, but give us the keys to decrypt it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, considering they built the infrastructure, they don't have to even, you don't need to give them the keys. They have the keys already. So maybe that's how they solve this problem. I don't know. It is an interesting challenge. I'll tee that up for my Google team and say, hey, what about this use case? Because that's definitely interesting.
Yeah, but what a valuable service, though. I can see so many things. I mean, you could even look for patterns of data exfiltration that didn't exist before, or maybe apply some kind of heuristics where you're not looking for a particular thing, you're just looking for a change in behavior from one day to the next, and then start flagging on, hey, maybe something's going on here. So
I assume that's what security researchers do all day, right? Like, it's, you know, like that's exactly what they're doing.
CrowdStrike, watch out. I mean, moving the agents from the VMs up to the hypervisor level is going to be a different billing model, and someone's going to be out of the loop.
I was thinking about Orca security too, right? Like, it's moving it down a layer where they wouldn't have access anymore as well.
Mm-hmm. Or do the cloud providers make that available to them as, you know, through a potential program, you could make that capability available. Mm-hmm. So interesting choices. All right. Well, even Google admits that when you're talking about Kubernetes, optimizing for reliability, performance, and cost efficiency is hard, which, you know, thanks Google for building a system that is none of those things, you know, that is hard to do and hard to be cost efficient. I really appreciate that. To help with cost optimizations, they have now released the GKE Cost Optimizations Insights, as now generally available, and it's gone through multiple improvements that will help you with your day-to-day optimizations. Its preview, it's easier now to spot under-provisioned workloads that could be at risk of instability due to insufficient resource requests, and now you have the insights, you can make the appropriate changes for your business and hopefully make your life easier, although they didn't really get into the specifics of all of that.
So the first optimization that they're communicating out is to ignore all the advice they were giving out as best practice for like the first several years of this platform, right?
Well, and the best practice that they now charge you for, because, you know, oh, multiple GKE clusters, perfect, we'll charge you for every one of those, fantastic. Other than the first one's free, after that it's all over. It's a little interesting how they've changed their tune on how to do Kubernetes in a big way. They even, in this article, they mentioned bin packing as a terrible strategy.
Oh, wow. So,
that it, you know, it seems like a great idea at first, but then it causes you some issues. So there you go. All right. Actually, they don't say it's bad. They just say you can save more money, but then they say you should be careful, though.
It's, so, you know, it's the age old cheap, faster, good, you know, pick two. Bin packing, you can use the same methodology there for that.
Agreed. All right, on to Azure with the new public preview of Microsoft Azure Payment HSM Service. Azure contends that many customers are looking to run their payment workloads in the cloud, and this typically entails migrating legacy on-premise applications and hardware security modules, or HSMs, to a cloud-based infrastructure that is not generally under their direct control. Cloud, of course, is a great choice for this, but there are some challenges that must be addressed when migrating legacy on-premise payment applications to cloud that need to be dealt with. First is shared responsibility and trust. What potential loss of control in some areas is acceptable to your business? Latency, how efficient, high performance is the link between the application and the HSM? Performing everything remotely, like how do you unlock your HSM when you're not physically in front of it with cards? That's a big issue. And so those might need to be modified. And then what security certifications and audit compliance changes will need to be required for you going to the cloud. To help you solve these challenges, Azure is excited to announce, of course, the Microsoft Azure Payment HSM. Azure Payment HSM is a bare metal service delivered using Fails PayShield 10K payment HSMs to provide cryptographic key operations for real-time critical payment transactions in the Azure cloud. Azure Payment HSM is designed specifically to help a service provider and individual financial institution accelerate their payment system's digital transformation strategy and adopt the public cloud while meeting the stringent security, audit, low latency, and high performance requirements of the payment card industry. Users of the system leverage Thales PayShield Manager for secure remote access to the HSM as part of their Azure subscription, and multiple subscription options are available to satisfy a broad range of performance and multiple applications requirements that can be upgraded quickly in line with end-user business growth. Azure Payment HSM offers the highest performance of 2,500 CPS, which is quite good for an HSM device.
There is some customer that's really happy about this. Because then it's finally they've met all the requirements. They don't have to do whatever hacky process of maintaining their own HSM or whatever. They could now just offload this, because this is, you know, it's a problem that a lot of people have. And you can see people dig in about, you know, the security of these transactions. It's important.
Yeah. This is the third HSM solution that Azure offers to you now, because you have, of course, the standard one that's built into most of the clouds. That's just, you know, you enable keys and all that. And then when security people go, no, you need to be FIPS compliant, you get the Azure dedicated HSM, which is dedicated to you and meets FIPS 140-2 level 3. And now you have this Thales PayShield, which is a third party solution, which apparently has some special sauce for PCI that I don't understand. So, you know, just make it more confusing. So this is, I guess you call this the premium HSA.
Yeah. I wonder how many customers this really targets. I mean, you don't see very many payment processors, and in most modern web apps would use PayPal, Google, Apple, you know, Shopify. There's a fair few around, but in terms of growth opportunity for Azure for this type of HSM, I really wonder what the market looks like.
I mean, I assume this allows them to go after people like Stripe and Square and other payment processors that are, you know, more nimble maybe and want to be more cloud ready. But yeah, I don't think Visa is going to move to it.
Right.
You know, in any big way.
It depends on how much of their existing, you know, platform they can leverage, right, to get that return on investment. So, you know, if they can just plug in, you know, a Thales HSM, then they get to capitalize on the PR of the partnership, and they can now sell this as an additional service.
Yeah.
They only need one to sell it, right?
Well,
let's see. Oracle region logic.
Yeah, I mean, how many do they have on the shelf? I guess, you know, is it the cost for a press release and a pair in one region for a customer?
Right, you know, well, just one rack will do us, you know, because they probably only buy at the rack level at a minimum. So, right. Well, Azure or AKS is now giving you cluster persistent volume backups, because what everyone wants to do with containers is put all their stateful data there, and so of course you need to then back it up and restore it. This is a private preview of AKS Persistent Volume Backup. You can now backup and restore the persistent volumes attached to your AKS cluster, allowing you to recover corrupted or deleted data of persistent volumes, or clone or replicate persistent volumes to dev and test environments. It's a little weird to me that they specifically said corrupted or deleted data of persistent volumes, because I'm hoping they mean someone deleted or corrupted the data on the volume, and that Azure is not corrupting or deleting your data that you would need to back it up. So I hope that means about files, and you can actually restore file level. But I refuse to reactivate my Azure account to go test this myself. So sorry.
Yeah. So all those years and presentations I did about how your container is not a VM and you need to, you know, treat it separately and consider it separately, I guess we should just give up on that and treat it like a VM.
That vision is already dead. I mean, we've got all these serverless functions and things now with persistent storage. I'm like, oh, come on.
Yeah, the days of you're not going to do stateful containers, that's definitely gone out the wayside, clearly. In fact, I was actually talking about a pretty ambitious idea with Kubernetes using stateful data the other day at work. So yes, even I have moved beyond this this argument. In many cases.
So. Can't beat them, join them.
Yeah, can't beat them, join them. I'm also multi-cloud now, right? Like, woo! anyways, let's move on to the lightning round. We have nothing from Oracle that I thought was worthy of mockery this week. So we'll just do lightning round, and then we'll wrap it up. So Peter's not here, so we divvied up the stories for various reading capabilities. And so I am up first with Azure Anomaly Detector adds synchronous multivariate detection and improved anomaly interpretation.
I forgot to.
I'm still looking.
I was busy reading mine, and I forgot to think of a joke.
You want me to try again?
I mean, that may be expecting a little much.
Yeah, we all know what happens when I try to be funny on these things on purpose.
Yeah, let me try one more time and see if you can recover. Azure Anomaly Detector adds synchronous multivariate detection and improved anomaly interpretation. Clearly, Ryan needs the Azure Anomaly Detector to decipher this headline for him, as I don't know half his words.
I'm just glad you assumed that Ryan was going to answer, not me, because I had nothing either.
Multivariate. I'm going to have to start using that.
Yes, your multivariant data is messing with our whatever. Generally available. Recovery points extended to 15 days with Azure Site Recovery.
Because when your site's down for 14 days, people now care about that extra day. Perfect.
It's never going to be...
get points for the recovery.
It's never going to be enough. Always will be one day more.
AWS Secrets Manager now supports rotation windows.
My car has rotation windows. But I always turn them the wrong way.
I mean, with this announcement, it's now only inevitable that we'll soon have the AWS Scheduler service, which will now schedule all of the maintenance windows and rotation windows across all their various things that you can specify, because they just keep giving them different names and different services.
just looking forward to scheduling those rotation windows at a different time than the maintenance windows, because halfway through deployment and whoop, all the credentials have changed.
Amazon EC2 customers can now use Recycle Bin to recover from accidental deletions of Amazon machine images, or AMIs.
I don't really have a joke, but I just envision like the "oh no" moment that caused this feature ask, and I want to give that person a hug.
That's the person who doesn't have an automated pipeline for golden images, and he deserves that Recycle Bin,
or their automated pipeline deleted all the images.
that's a fair, yeah, okay.
I'll let you know in a couple months.
It's a neat feature, actually. I mean, I assume it's just hiding it from being deployable rather than being like an E2 Recycle Bin. I see why they did it, but yeah, it makes a lot of sense that you can test what would happen if. What happens if I do this thing?
Oh, I didn't think of that.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Because I will use the crap out of that if that's true, because I do run an automated pipeline for machine images, and that's now I can have a process that gets rid of them. That's excellent.
That's good. AWS Storage Gateway enables on-premise users to recover previous versions of files on Amazon FSx File Gateway. The IT help desk guy who measures his success and worth by ticket counts is now crying in the corner.
I like that you just gave up on Jonathan and read that one.
I closed the tab. Actually, I put it in the recycle bin.
I'll let him take the last one to make up for it. It's fine.
Getting started with Google Cloud Logging Python version 3.0.0.
Which I'm like, oh, this is really cool. And then you find out just adding metadata to your logs so you can store more junk in your logs.
Oh, I like the visuals of a Python swallowing logs. That's pretty nice. It lies down next to you in bed. If you fit, you won't be there in the next morning. Anyway, Amazon SageMaker Autopilot now provides confusion matrix and additional new insights for classification problems.
This is the proof that Amazon is trying to replace Ryan, who lives in a constant state of confusion.
Mm-hmm. One might say that I, live in a confusion matrix where, I just walk around being Neo going, whoa, all the time. See, that's what happens when I try to be funny.
It was, you really pulled for that one. I see. I don't think we'll score that just because we all sucked at this.
It does.
Sorry, listeners. It was not great.
Yeah.
Right. Well, things coming up. The open source day is coming up next week, and they're already pimping it with all kinds of videos. By the time this episode drops, it'll already have happened. But you can probably check out all the videos. The SQL Server and Azure SQL Conference, April 5th through 7th, is still coming up, as well as many other exciting conferences you can find in our show notes. We'll pimp or a little bit closer to them. So there you go. That is another fantastic week here in the cloud.
Indeed.
See everybody.
And that is the Week in Cloud. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Foghorn Consulting. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and tweet us your feedback at #TheCloudPod. Or join our Slack channel, go to our website, thecloudpod.net, for sign-up instructions.